From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Friday, September the 11th, 2020, 19th anniversary of those terrible events of September 11th, 2001, the attacks on our country, which have reverberated ever since. And I'm seeing online and elsewhere in the media and so on, lots of reminiscences about where folks were that day, what they were doing. It was a gorgeous, clear blue sky day, and certainly was shattered by those events. And we are going to be talking about other stuff today, though. May save a 9/11 retrospective for the 20th anniversary, perhaps next September 11th. But today we're going to talk about some recent news having to do with President Trump and a new book out from Bob Woodward, the longtime Washington Post journalist. And we're going to be talking to a working journalist, a former journalist, a journalism professor in this hour about a journalistic ethics question. And that is, if Woodward came up with definitive material and recorded on the record interviews with President Trump indicating that President Trump was lying about the severity of the coronavirus crisis back in February and March, and did not publish immediately in the Washington Post, but save that material up for this book that's due out next week, was that a bad practice by Woodward? Was he okay doing that? We're going to talk about that with former Rutland Herald managing editor Steve Terry, with Lisa Scalotti, who is the editor of the Waterbury Roundabout and has been teaching journalism up at the University of Vermont. And we are also going to be talking later this hour with David Mindich, who is a former head of the journalism department at St. Michael's College in Colchester, and has since moved on to Temple University in Philadelphia to a very similar job down there, bigger school. And so we'll be talking with the three of them, although not all together, because Lisa will just be with us for the first half hour, and then David Mindich steps in for the balance of this hour. Later on in the program, we're going to shift gears and talk about poetry. Samantha Colbert, poet in Montpelier, is out with a new collection called Birth of a Daughter, and it's all about her becoming a mom and what that experience was like, rendered in poetry. Very interesting artistic effort there, and we're going to be talking with her about that in the second half hour. In between, we've got a conversation with Bob Ney, one of our, if not our absolute favorite, national correspondent, who comes on every Friday now and talks about what's going on the national scene out there. He may have some words also about this latest book. It seems like there's a new book out every week, a scandal book about President Trump. Last week it was, of course, Michael Schmidt of the New York Times writing about how no one ever really adequately investigated the question of whether Trump, in fact, has been performing as some kind of a Russian asset, and whether Vladimir Putin and the Russians have something on Trump causing him to do that, etc. And some of the same kind of questions have been raised about Schmidt's effort, actually, in the sense that, you know, should he have come out with the stuff earlier in the stories in the New York Times? So we'll get into this conversation right now with our two of our guests. I believe Lisa Scalotti and Steve Terry are both on the phone with us. And to the two of you, I welcome you to the program, and thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Dave. Good morning. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning, Steve and Dave. Thanks for having me.
Glad to do it. So I'm going to start with Lisa. Lisa, I was on the phone with you yesterday afternoon, and my ear almost burned off.
No.
You have quite a strong view about this. What is it?
Well, it's been an interesting conversation to have, especially with some of the students that I'm working with now, about what's news, and when is it a reporter's obligation to report the news, right? That's kind of what this whole question that you're posing about Woodward and the information that he gathered from the president himself, and whether that information was immediate enough to be a story, or if it was a good idea for him to, you know, sit on it for a number of months for it to be part of his book. So it's a good conversation to have. I mean, I hate to be the one to second guess Bob Woodward, who is, you know, like the master out there, but it's interesting to see how now so much of these details are coming out not in sort of daily news reporting, but in this book form, right? Like you just said, there's different people that are coming forward now collecting information and publishing books in their accounts or doing their first-person accounts of what they've seen and the experience that they've had. And so, to some extent, it's like they're saving the juicy bits for the books and not sprinkling them out in the newspapers like Woodward and Bernstein did back in the early 70s, right, with the Washington Post reports as they drip, drip, drip reported on Watergate.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I would have trusted that Bob Woodward's spidey sense probably went up during many times during these 18 interviews that he said he had with the president, where he learned all sorts of interesting, you know, details about the president's thinking. And so, you know, should that have come out sooner? This is a big one as far as the president saying, yeah, I know certain things to be true, but that's not what I'm going to be telling people when I speak publicly.
Yeah.
That's tough. That's tough to hear. And how do you sit on that for a number of months?
Especially if you're a reporter who first came to fame as somebody who was breaking great stories on a daily basis. So, yeah, that's interesting. Steve Terry, I'm wondering, do you think that some of what's going on here, this idea of saving things up for a book as opposed to running them out in the daily newspaper, is that a sign that that daily newspapers have diminished in stature since the publication of all the Watergate stories in, say, 1973 or so?
Well, let me just make one very important comment. And
okay.
First of all, Bob Woodward is no longer a daily journalist. And as a matter of fact, he's no longer employed by the Washington Post. He does have an honorary title there, but he is not and has not for several years been an active player in the newsroom, unlike Michael Schmidt of the New York Times, who was still employed by the New York Times. So,
mm-hmm.
with that as a background, I do believe that Bob Woodward made the right call in keeping these conversations going on the record, recorded with President Trump for this release this week. And I think the impact of it is much more profound, much more important now than it would have been if in early February Bob came back to the newsroom, rushed a story out with what Trump said. And as we saw yesterday, we know exactly what Trump's reaction would have been. Oh, I was not lying, he said. I was trying to not cause panic. And you know what? A week later, that story would have been forgotten. This Bob Woodward book will not be forgotten.
Certainly not as easily or not as soon. I would think you're right about that, Stephen. And I think you make an important distinction also to note. Woodward is in his 70s now, and, you know, that's retirement age. And
right.
Certainly for someone in who's worked for a long time for a daily newspaper like the Washington Post, they are, you know, the staff at the Post are represented by the Newspaper Guild. He's probably collecting a pension these days. And so
I suspect it's a very handsome one.
And so I would think that we basically have a retired journalist. Lisa, does that make a difference? Should he still have at least gone to the editors at the Post and said, "Hey, I have great material for daily stories here. I could write him up, or we can hand him off to your current staff."
Well, yeah. I mean, I think I understand Bob Woodward's position these days. He's not a daily reporter anymore, but he still has some pretty good connections at the Washington Post.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he either could have gotten himself a freelance gig if he wanted to, or, you know, I would not have thought that he would have jeopardized his interviews, for sure. Having the ability to be sitting down with the president and having the president running off at the mouth as he was priceless. So You don't want to get in the way of that, and you want to let that run its course. So having this come out in February before people even knew that this virus was much of a thing that we needed to be paying attention to, that might have been too early. He himself in interviews has said that he needed to feel comfortable to nail down that this was actually the case and had to do verifying, et cetera, and that his reporting didn't feel like that was on solid ground until about late April or early May, something like that. But that's still May, and now we're here in September. I don't know if that would have diminished his book or diminished the reaction, but I feel like there's this piece of truth there that has been withheld, and I don't know if our job as journalists is to just wait and see and ask ourselves, well, will this story really make an impact today? Maybe it'll make an impact later. I'll sit on it. It seems like that was news when it was news, and for the people of the country to know that the president is, we know he deliberately lies about many things, that he puts out falsehoods all the time, so that's sort of within his character. But for people to know that he was deliberately putting out misinformation about something that important, I would like to think that sooner rather than later would have been a better time to hear that. It would have still caused a lot of the same reaction as far as people saying it's fake news, et cetera. But it is in his own voice, and he could have shared those tapes with Philip Rucker or someone else on the Washington Post staff to have been able to run with that story.
Philip Rucker, of course, is the White House bureau chief with the paper these days.
Right. I had a student ask me if maybe the reporting the truth doesn't matter until we write the history books, but the truth right now doesn't matter, which really kind of gave me pause,
yeah.
I suppose.
You know, they used to say journalism is the first rough draft of history. Woodward is saying, you know, I'm good enough at journalism. I don't need to do a first rough draft anymore.
Well, actually, Dave, that's where I was going. He was interviewed by the ombudsman, the Washington Post, a couple of days ago, and one of his interesting comments was that he wanted to take time, he wanted to verify what he was hearing, because he wanted to do, here we go, the second draft of history. So, in that perspective, I think back to your earlier question, Dave. Is daily journalism the best place still to have this kind of breaking news? And instinctively, my feeling is yes. But I must say that in the recent months, with especially the Michael Schmidt book and this one, having it in a context in which you can make your own judgments and think about what is being written, I think is a very, very powerful new force in journalism. And it's hard writing a book. It's hard writing something about that's happening all around you without getting totally sort of washed over by the daily events. It does seem that that readers, and unfortunately, and voters in this country now just do not seem to want to take the time to look at all of the context of events. The fact that President Trump would call Bob Woodward often late at night 18 times for close to 10 hours of on-the-record discussions is a hugely important contribution for Americans voting in 53 days.
The president yesterday tweeted, "Bob Woodward had my quotes for many months. If he thought they were so bad or dangerous, why didn't he immediately report them in an effort to save lives? Didn't he have an obligation to do so?" No, because...
Go ahead, Steve. Say maybe Bob Woodward didn't believe what he heard, because, you know, he's interviewing a person, as Lisa commented, who lies 20 times a day. So I can understand his being somewhat cautious, and the need for him to also verify some of this stuff. As we know, just because it's in the president's own words does not always mean it's true.
Yeah, actually, Lisa, you and I were talking about this very question yesterday, that veracity thing, and your argument, I think, was basically if you get it straight from the horse's mouth, you pretty much have it. There's not much verification left to do. But Steve is saying here that if it's from Donald Trump, there's plenty of verification left to do. What do you think?
Well, I agree with Steve's point first about how having a lot of these details now trying to come out in books where they're in good context and with more information around these new revelations is helpful for people who want to try to understand what's happening as the first draft of history. I think what makes this situation a little different is the fact that if the topic is about something that public information and public messaging matters, because people are behaving in certain ways that could either help them stay healthy or could be dangerous and could lead to them getting sick or even dying or transmitting a dangerous disease. Mm-hmm. So I think that kind of puts it at a different, the stakes are higher at that point. And at this point, the message is, the information wasn't necessarily, is he correct? We know what the scientists were saying, what the medical experts were saying. The point is that he was able to confirm to Woodward that he was hearing the information from the scientists, but he was choosing to tell people something different. And there are certain people who are going to believe the medical experts and are going to tune him out because they don't believe that he's truthful. But there are, you know, half the country actually is listening to him, and his messaging matters. And so would that have made a difference for the people who actually believe what he says and they don't believe what the media says about him? If they hear him in his own words saying, I'm putting out something different because I just deciding that this message should not be so dire, I don't want to scare people, about something that actually is pretty scary, maybe that would have made a difference. But even so, when you look at it now, here we are in September. He held a rally for thousands of people in Michigan last night. Mm-hmm. No masks, no distancing, packing people into an airplane hangar. We've now heard him say that he knows that this is dangerous and he knows that this is, you know, five times more deadly than the flu. But yet he's still scheduling events and inviting people who are supporting him to gather in these ways that are, you know, clearly dangerous as far as public health goes. And it still doesn't matter.
I want to push back on something, though. You said, Lisa, just before the interview, which is that President Trump's supporters needed this information, but none of them believes the media. So the Washington Post comes out with a story saying, hey, we have the president recorded on the record interview acknowledging he's been downplaying the coronavirus. He would have just said fake news and on we go, right?
Well, they have a recording of him. Would they not believe a recording? Or maybe they don't. Maybe they don't. Clearly they aren't, because they're still going out to rallies. And they're ignoring the advice of the health experts, and instead, you know, registering for their tickets and showing up in large numbers at these public events that are ill-advised, probably for health reasons. But I don't know. We can you know, sort of Monday morning quarterback this like crazy at this point. But months have gone by, and many people. Here we are on September 11th, where. Just think about this, 19 years ago, you know, 2,000 some people died, and we were horrified. We were horrified. It stopped us in our tracks for a very long time, and we were just stunned at how much of an impact that was, and that was staggering to think of. And right now, every 3 or 4 days, that many people are dying in America, and we're just, it's so much right now has become normalized that it's really frightening to think what we've kind of, I don't know, just gotten accustomed to it in the last couple of years.
We have a listener calling in, Mike from Northfield. Oh, yeah. Good morning, Mike. Mike, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
What's on your mind?
Yes. Hello. yes. I don't understand why anyone would want to blame Bob Woodward for what Donald Trump has done. We've all known all along that he lies and that he doesn't follow the science or the doctors or anything. And Woodward's just bringing it out to light with a recording, and I think it's wonderful. I think it is too bad he didn't do it earlier, but I know he was making a book, so...
Better late than never?
It isn't his fault. It's Donald Trump's fault.
Okay, Mike, thanks for the call. I appreciate that important clarification or distinction there that... If you want to cast blame in this whole thing, or certainly in these exchanges between Woodward and Trump, Trump probably does score lower, I think, on most ethical scales here.
Trump is the one that initiated the calls, from what I heard.
In many cases, yeah.
Yeah.
Let me ask Steve Terry. Steve, there's been a long-standing tradition in journalism. For reporters to be kind of detached and standoffish, and you know, in journalism classes, they discuss these events where a photographer comes across a starving child who's being visited by a buzzard, and the photographer takes the Pulitzer Prize winning shot, but does the photographer intervene to try to help the child and this kind of thing? Would this have been an act of public health in, advocacy involvement if Woodward had come out and made statements that were basically designed to inform some segment of the American public that, in fact, this is more dire than the president is saying, amid all the stream of information we were getting from Fauci and Birx and all the rest of them?
Right. But, see, I think what all of us maybe are missing a bit, and both Lisa and you and I are used to people in public life maybe trying to bend the truth a little bit, but we've never had a situation where an elected leader like Donald Trump can stand before you, even with his own words recorded, to say, well, that's not what I said or meant, and then have his ardent supporters, about 35% maybe of the American voters, just totally believe him. And now it's to the point where his Republican allies in the Congress will not be critical of him for the most part.
Steve, I got to stop you there because I think we are about to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS news. We're going to be speaking with David Mindich in the second half hour. Lisa Scolodi has to go. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Dave, and I hope people pay attention to all the other news in Woodward's book, because I have a feeling there's a lot more that we could be talking about.
A lot more there, that's for sure. Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
Finally.
Steve Terry is staying with us for the balance of the hour here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. And we're going to go to some bottom of the hour CBS News, a couple words from our sponsors, and be back with Steve and with David Mindich of the Temple University Journalism Department. We'll be back very shortly, folks.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Dilly takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We are back, and we're talking about Bob Woodward and his new book coming out this coming week, talking about the President of the United States. 18 hours of on-the-record interviews and recorded, in fact, interviews. So the veracity is really holding up quite well. And the questions now are coming in from some quarters asking whether Bob Woodward, the journalist, longtime Washington Post journalist, Watergate fame, and many books under his belt now about several administrations, should he have come out earlier with news about some of the statements that the president was making, indicating he knew he was downplaying the threat of the coronavirus, or is it okay to save up those pretty juicy tidbits for your book? And so we were talking about that in the first half hour with Lisa Scalotti, a longtime Vermont journalist, now editor of the Waterbury Roundabout, as well as with Steve Terry, who a former editor, managing editor of the Rutland Herald, who, like Woodward, has gone on from journalism and has been more recently writing books. And Lisa had to take a vet or pet to the vet, I guess, or something, so she had to leave us. But we have an able pinch hitter now coming in, and that is David Mindich. He is the former head of the journalism department at St. Michael's College in Colchester, now doing very similar work at Temple University in Philadelphia. And David Mindich, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And Steve Terry continues with us, and so we'll, I'm sure, have a lively conversation this half hour. Steve, I was asking you before the break, you know, one of the arguments here is that Bob Woodward, if he had gotten this information out earlier, might have saved a few lives. People might have understood that the president was downplaying the coronavirus and perhaps taking it more seriously, behaved a bit differently, et cetera. And one of the key purposes that I think we've all seen this year of public health work is conveying information to the public about how to avoid risk and increase chances of safety and all that good stuff. And certainly that's what people like Anthony Fauci, Deborah Birx, the CDC, all those folks are all about, really, professionally. And people are, I think, pointing the finger at Bob Woodward and saying maybe he should have stepped into that role a little bit as a conveyor of public health information to the public. My question is, does that violate the long-standing tradition in journalism that reporters actually need to minimize their own involvement in a story, and do they need to sort of stand back more and just be observers? I'll put that first to you, Steve.
Sure. Well, I mean, as I started to answer, we are in a total different circumstance now with this particular president. I would say, if we were back in the journalism that you and I knew, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, it would be a journalist would be reluctant to become a voice of alarm that way. They would have maybe written a story, but they would not have turned it into a public campaign, other than what they might find in their new journalism about that event. So I think journalism has changed to a certain extent, but I also don't think that, given Bob Woodward's history, that he would have viewed himself as another voice like Dr. Fauci or Dr. Birx. I think those experts, health experts, were sounding this alarm for months, and Donald Trump ignored it. Just as I would argue, if Woodward had written a story in early February about what Trump told him, that he was that he knew it was bad, but he was playing it down, that Trump would have, even though his voice is there, he would have tried to spin his way out of it, and a lot of people who would believe him. And I just think that the way Woodward has done this is right, because now hopefully the total impact of his interviews, 18 hours with Donald Trump, it'll be hard although he will try to lie his way out of it. But we won't know for another 53 days.
David Mindich, I'm curious to get your thoughts on this question. If Woodward had said, I need to be out there correcting the stream of public information that's going out for the purposes of preserving public health, which is, you know, what some of the argument we're hearing now is, would he have crossed that line of becoming too involved in the story and lost his journalistic detachment, do you think?
Right. So, you know, one of the questions is, would this have saved lives? And you know, frankly, I think that it's a difficult question to answer. It may have. I mean, certainly would in February and March, it would have been good to know that not only, I mean, I think the assumption was, and my assumption was, that Trump didn't really understand the severity of it, and that's one of the reasons why he's playing it down. What Woodward has uncovered was that he did understand it, and in fact, it was just pure hypocrisy to tell America that it wasn't a big deal, while knowing, in fact, that it is a big deal. So it's a serious, I mean, it's a blockbuster, serious bit of information that could have saved lives. I think that the information now can save lives. The electorate can decide in just under 2 months whether to reelect Trump, and they can use that information as part of their thinking. And the pandemic is going to go beyond in November, so actually Woodward's revelations will in fact impact the country from here on in.
Interesting perspective there. Let's bring a listener into the conversation. I believe Fred from Montpelier is on the line. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning. I don't think it would have saved any lives and stuff, the people that agree with Trump. Trump would have just said it's fake news and stuff. The Trump believers, you know, he said it was night when it was day. They believe him. It's a mood issue.
Okay. Thank you very much, Fred. Appreciate that that thought. I do think that's interesting, and Fred may have some basis for that because this has happened so often where some revelation comes out about the administration and the president says, labels it fake news, and his supporters immediately label it fake news. And basically, we just wait 6 hours for the next scandal to break. Steve Terry,
look what happened last night, David. Trump holds a rally in Michigan and called the Woodward conversations and the book, even though he hasn't read it, he said, a hit job. And that immediately is a message point that the ardent Trump backers are talking about this morning. So I think that the previous caller was right on when it would not have unfortunately made a difference then. And I hope that David is right. Now that we know it now, we can react. But I'm rather pessimistic based on what we witnessed last night in Trump's rally in Michigan.
I agree, except that I'm not sure that the Trump supporters are the people. I mean, I'm pretty sure that the Trump supporters are not the people that will be deciding the election, right? I don't think there's probably going to be much movement among Trump supporters, but there's maybe a third of the electorate or maybe a quarter of the electorate are independents and undecided to this point. Reasonable people who are open to the idea that their views about Trump might change could be swayed by this. And the other audience that we have to keep in mind, and this is something that Woodward mentioned, is the people who are interested in the second draft of history, journalism is often called the first draft of history, and Woodward has said that he wanted to write the second draft. In other words, something that was more thorough over time and that can last the test of history. And so, you know, he conducted interviews from December to July. Had he said, uncovered this news in March, the interviews would have been over, and he would have lost out some more interviews, in April, May, June, July. And I think that the world will be richer for those extra interviews that wouldn't have happened had he revealed his information in March.
Well, David, I think that's a very, very interesting point, especially I'm looking right now, actually, at a piece from The Hill using a quote that the president gave Woodward on June 19th. Now, remember, June 19th interview, I think you're right, probably would not have happened if the president felt that Woodward had been burning him by publishing his earlier comments all through March and April. They were talking about white privilege and about the anger of black Americans following the death of George Floyd and Rashard Brooks, etc. And the president basically said, here's the quote from President Trump. He's talking to Woodward. He says, "No, you really drank the Kool-Aid, didn't you?" This is, Woodward's talking all about, you know, white privilege and black anger and these issues of racial tension in the United States and so on. The president says, "No, you really drank the Kool-Aid, didn't you? And just listen to you. Wow. No, I don't feel that at all." This is the president being asked if he has any empathy for black Americans and the fact that they may be upset about things. And my word, that quote is pretty telling, and I think likely would not have happened June 19th if in fact these stories had been published back earlier in March or so. What do you think, Steve Terry?
I think David's view on that is spot on. It would not have, these further interviews would not have happened. And we would have been, this book, as Woodward calls it, the second draft of history, we would not have had that. And we know that if this president loses, which, many Americans hope, but it'll be because of this COVID issue and his total, he just has not dealt with it. And he's been absolutely incompetent the way he and his close advisors have dealt with. But I put the blame on Trump. Bob Woodward could not have, quote, saved the situation. He might have gotten more people to ask questions if he had published earlier, but given the history in the last several months, I don't think the result would be much different, and we would still be today looking at almost 200,000 American deaths.
All right. Let's bring in a listener. And I got a special shout out for this one. Marcia from Barrie called yesterday and kind of got me onto this topic. So you can praise her or blame her for the fact that we're spending the first hour of today's show on this conversation about the responsibility of a journalist to report things when he or she finds them out. Marcia from Barrie, good morning.
Good morning, Dave, and good morning to your guests, and thank you very much for following up with this thoughtful and authoritative show. And I think everybody is right, and in particular the point which was brought up yesterday and echoed by your guest about the cultivation of a source. And you have to do it very carefully, and you don't want to jeopardize that the source might leave. Now, Woodward, of course, has plenty of experience with this with Mark Felt, deep deep throat. But yep. I think you're all right. I think there are cases, though, where reporters find a way to intervene or express what they know. But this is a situation where we all are emotionally raw from 4 years of hurt from this man and his administration. And when you go from one crisis to another in a pot that has been boiling us like frogs for four years, and you reach to this point where we are grasping like primates to find a leader, and we just want someone to save us from the peril that we are in. And when we can't look and find a leader, we're grasping for someone else, like Bob Woodward, and, you know, to point and see. But there have been plenty of people in the administration working and saying things. It's just, and not doing anything to help.
So, well, I'm just trying to keep up. First we were...
enormous frustration.
Yeah, I get where you're coming from on that, Marsha, but I thought something was funny that you said. I think you referred to frogs and then to primates, and I'm thinking, well, at least we're evolving, right? No, I shouldn't go there. Just to, you know. Anyway, let's see.
Thank you for hearing me.
Yeah, thank you for calling, Marsha. I think you're a very thoughtful person, and I many of our listeners are, and I really appreciate that about this opportunity to share some time with you every morning. And hey, Steve Terry, what do you think about this? I mean, is there a sense that this is the boiling point here? Just, you know, to use that old metaphor about frogs and boiling water.
You know, maybe that I'm a optimist. This may be the event that actually galvanizes the thinking of voters who have not made up their mind yet, which was an important point that David made. But, you know, we haven't seen the rest of the book.
Yeah.
basically...
Wait till next week.
10 hours of... Right. Who knows?
Yep.
And I think we can get more. We'll have more commentary on Trump's views of the military generals and that establishment. Mm-hmm. I mean, and who knows? He has... new ways each week now of reaching new lows, and I think some of those may well be revealed.
Here's an email from a Christy McLeod, one of our listeners. Trump is a master marketing strategist. He has now shifted the discussion from his deceit to the American public to a national discussion on Bob Woodward. This is just wrong. David Mindich, what do you think? Have we been getting it just wrong this whole first hour of my program this morning?
Well, you know, if he's such a master of anything, why would he sit down with Bob Woodward? The story is that he thought that he could win Bob Woodward over with his charm. And, you know, that to me should probably rank up there with certainly the top 100 crazy things that Trump has done in the last 4 years. I mean, the idea that, you know, the guy that brought down Nixon and has had this storied career in journalism, holding leaders accountable, would somehow be won over by Trump's charm. I mean, that really does show a little bit of tortured thinking on Trump's part.
The stable genius, I guess, maybe thinks he's more charming than Richard Nixon. Is that what's going on here?
Well, that might be true, but that's a low bar. No,
I don't know.
That's a very good way to make an observation. I was in Washington working for George Aiken, Senator Aiken, during that time of the Nixon resignation. And that was a time when a lie, an obvious lie, could make people react, like his Republican colleagues finally told Nixon, okay, this is it, you need to resign. And
yep.
That, so we are in a different context, that's all.
Different context, for sure. Hey, I got to wrap it up. Steve Terry and David Mindich, I really appreciate your time this morning. Thank you very much for joining me. We're going to go to a top of the hour break for some CBS News. Back with Bob Ney in a few minutes. Stay with us.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Daily takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry. Puzzles and toys for all ages. Art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We are back, entering into our second hour of the program on this Friday morning, September the 11th. And again, the 19th anniversary continues to bring forth memories of where people were that fateful morning. September 11, 2001, when our nation was attacked, of course, planes flying into the World Trade Center, both towers, the Pentagon in Washington, or just outside of Washington, and a plane that crashed in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, brought down by very brave passengers who were trying to avert a worse disaster in the making. The 9/11, obviously, is something that still resonates very, very strongly with quite a number of Americans, with most Americans, or nearly all Americans, I would say. Lisa Scolodi, a guest in the previous hour, talking about Bob Woodward, Donald Trump, and all of that, made a very interesting point, I think, where she was saying that you know, we lost nearly 3,000 lives on September the 11th, 2001. And that's happening about every few days with the coronavirus right now. And I wonder sometimes if we have become too inured to all of this. This is really an ongoing tragedy that seems unrelenting. Just saw another news report, I think, last evening, in which looks like numbers are ticking up again after ticking down for a bit. I think we'll see a lot of that for a while to come, where you know you hope things are starting to wane and then they increase again. Very, very tough times for our country and the world, but particularly for our country, since the United States seems to have had a harder time than many other especially developed countries in developing good responses to the pandemic. Bob Ney joins us, our regular Friday national correspondent, and Bob is on the phone. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I cannot complain. Not yet.
You always bring a lot of interesting international flavor to your proposed topics. You very kindly send me a little list in the morning. You know, here's stuff we could talk about. And one thing that I wanted to get to on your list concerns Joe Biden, foreign policy. He's basically saying that he'd love to see troops come home from places like Afghanistan, but the United States needs to remain vigilant against terrorism. Tell us about what you're finding and hearing from the Biden campaign and from the candidate himself, because, you know, people are going to have to make a choice upcoming, and they ought to be informed as to where this guy stands.
Well, this is interesting because I worked directly with Senator Biden and his office on the Iranian issues over the years. And mm-hmm. Let me just say this, Dave, and I think this is recognized by both parties in D.C., anybody that's served in the Congress, nobody knows foreign policy and the nuances of it better than Joe Biden. It's just a fact. I mean, that's what he was really known for more than the Judiciary Committee. So mm-hmm. all of a sudden now you have Biden making the news because you've got Trump saying, you know, he wants to pull out more troops and take the troops out. And Biden told yesterday the Stars and Stripes, and that's a military, you know, newsletter, that he supports a sustained U.S. military footprint up to 1,500 to 2,000 on the ground, primarily for special operations against ISIS. So here you have the Democrat nominee saying, wait a minute, you know, we have to have, you know, something in there to back this up with our troops. And then he did agree with Trump on certain troop withdrawals if, in fact, Trump would then find a way to not let ISIS, you know, have the total rule. Now, progressives, here's the reaction. And the campaign, the Biden campaign, I talked to somebody yesterday that's associated with the campaign, and basically, in a very polite way, they're like, you know, this is his position, and nobody is going to, you know, alter this because of a philosophical bent. And it's not that he's a warmonger, is what the campaign's saying, but bottom line, Dave, progressives are not happy with this statement, obviously. They want
wars. Yeah, they take a much more ambitious stance generally toward the idea of reducing United States involvement overseas, military involvement in particular overseas. Do you think that, I mean, one of the real crucial questions of this upcoming election will be the role of progressives and, you know, Democrats who, you know, maybe supported Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren in the primaries. They're trying to work out, I think, a sort of a grumbling acceptance of Joe Biden for the next 4 years. And this doesn't help that, does it?
No. And of course, if you ask a progressive who's angry about, you know, Biden's position today, are you going to vote for Trump? You know what that answer is going to be. No. But on the future of the progressives in the Democratic Party, this is a different ballgame. If Joe Biden loses to Donald Trump in November, mm-hmm. I promise you the progressive movement will lay a marker down within the Democratic Party and said, we tried it your way, we want it our way. Well, you know, with a candidate like Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, you know, a progressive candidate.
Maybe the progressives could be said they're just biding their time until AOC turns 35 in October of 24.
Right. But, true. I mean, that's possibly true.
I don't think Bernie Sanders is going to be running again in 24. He'd be what, 82 or something like that.
Warren.
Well, Elizabeth Warren's getting up there too, you know, I think eventually you do have to start looking toward the next generation of leadership. And anyway, there was this phenomenon of progressives either staying home in 16. Or voting for Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate. There is a Green Party candidate running this year. I know a handful of people here in Vermont who are talking seriously about voting for that person. Of course, the calculus up here is that you can vote for whoever you want to in Vermont. It's going to Biden. But nationally, you know, maybe in places like Wisconsin or Michigan, you know, a serious slice peeling off to stay home or vote for leftist party out of dissatisfaction with Joe Biden's foreign policy stances or any other stances, really. Is there a chance that we could have a repeat performance of 16?
Well, I mean, that's always a possibility. Look, here's the bottom, because you've laid it out completely correctly. If you look at Wisconsin and Ohio and Pennsylvania and Michigan, because Ohio's tightened up, if you look mm-hmm. at states like that, every vote's going to count. And if somebody peels off votes for whatever reason and they don't support Joe Biden, they are giving Donald Trump one way or the other a vote.
Yeah, I think that's pretty true. And I mean, I think one of the things that that the Biden folks are hoping for and the Democrats are hoping for is that they're going to develop some reasons for Republicans to abstain. not either stay home or just not mark the ballot for president or whatever because of dissatisfaction with Trump's handling the coronavirus crisis or his certainly his remarks about military folks and so on. I could see many people going to the polls who either served in the military themselves or have loved ones who were in the military and just deciding based on that alone that they're done with this guy.
Right. And look, yesterday in Ohio, there's the Lincoln Project and also the Grant Association, and named mm-hmm. after Ulysses S. Grant. And they are very vocal. These are not just some registered Republican that the Democrats grab and say, hey, will you put your name on this? This is a former chair of the Belmont County Republican Party who's running this thing, and they are out there vocal on the steps of the Capitol. And I looked up and saw a former attorney general's son, the United States, was out there too. And I'm like, okay, this isn't just, you know, some name you pick. These are people that are doing their best to make sure that Donald Trump's not in office.
This is, you said the Grant Association?
Yes, it's called Grant. Grant Foundation, it's called, named after Ulysses S. Grant. And
I've heard of the Lincoln Project, but this must be a spinoff or something.
Grant, wow. It was formed by Chris Gagin, who used to be chair of the Republican Party in Belmont County, Ohio, where I'm from.
Got it. Okay. Interesting. Hey, Bob, do you have time to listen to a caller calling in, checking in with us?
Sure. Absolutely. Sure.
Let's go to Paul in Moncton. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Dave. Good morning, Bob. Hey, very quickly, I have a question regarding the election, but not specific to the presidential race, more about the role that the lack of college students on campus will play in an election, you know, specific to cities and states, and that if they're not there, they're not voting within a certain state if they're from another state. And I'm just curious as to, you know, what that type of impact might be, if anybody's thought about it. I know in Vermont, our university is in session, so kids are there, but you know, a lot of other states with out-of-state students who aren't showing up for campus this year and will have an impact. And I just don't know if that's been discussed at all.
Ooh. That's now, Dave, the caller is raising a point I never thought about because they're not back at college. We have this big debate, as you do across the nation. People say students in Ohio that don't live in Ohio and they're going to Gambier College or Kenyon College, they shouldn't be able to vote. Well, we've established they should if they're on campus, you know. But the caller makes a great point, and this could make a big deal difference. It really could. If they're not back into these colleges and they're in their home states, because a lot of times they'll have an impact. For example, if the students in Ohio, and it's going to be a close call here for both candidates, if the students were here in Ohio, it would be a big voting force potentially, but most of the universities are not back.
Boy, that is an interesting point. A question Paul raises. I mean, one of the things I wonder. I'd first want to try to ascertain what has been the historic pattern when a student is from one state and goes to college in another state. Does the student most often vote by absentee in his or her home state? Or does the student most often register as a new voter in the state where the college is located? So that would be a baseline question, I think. And then you're going to look for changes in those patterns based on the fact that quite a number of students are actually not located physically in the states where they've been going to college. They're back home doing coursework remotely. In many instances, and what does that mean? I guess the message here would be that if you are a student in that situation, you better double check your registration. Make sure you are registered where you need to be, and if you want to vote in November, either that or I suppose you know, it's possible that, I mean, let's say you were a Vermont kid who is going to school at you know, University of Massachusetts at Amherst, let's say. My alma mater, are you going to vote in Vermont or in Massachusetts? Well, I guess theoretically, if you're registered to vote in Amherst, Mass., you could get an absentee ballot from the Amherst town clerk and vote that way. Or if you are registered to vote in your hometown in Vermont, you could just do that because you're back home. And so I think it's something that could be figured out, but that's on the to-do list now, folks. So,
did they change in time? I will bet you the question that Paul just asked
when this election is done, is going to be thoroughly researched across the United States, because it's a great question for future situations like this.
Yep, that's why I love the hive mind of our listeners here on WDEV, FM, and AM.
That was one of the better questions I've heard.
All right. Gets the prize for this week anyway, right, Bob? Hey, Bob Nay, I really appreciate you joining us this morning, keeping you a little long, but I do appreciate that. Thank you so much. Let's do it again next week.
Thank you. Okay.
All righty. We have quite a burgeoning group of poets here in Vermont. We have featured a few on our air in recent times. I know when Steve Pappas was a guest host here a few months back, he had Karen McCadden on, and then I interviewed Scudder Parker, who was also out with a recent collection of poetry recently here on the Dave Graham Show on DEV. And today it's Samantha Colbert's turn. She is a poet based in Montpelier. She wears a few different hats. I think many people who first passion is writing poetry find different ways to support that, make a living and that sort of thing. Samantha is events coordinator at Bear Pond Books in Montpelier and also is the poetry editor at Rootstock Publishing, a very interesting small publishing house based in Montpelier. And Samantha is going to talk to us this morning about a new collection of poetry that she just published called Birth of a Daughter, all about becoming a new mom. And I believe Samantha Colbert is on the phone with us. Good morning, Samantha. Thank you very much for joining me.
Good morning, Dave. Thanks for having me.
And so this is, I was reading some of the poetry here last night, and it's really quite fascinating, and it's clearly of a theme about you giving birth to your daughter. Now I'm curious, how many children do you have? Just the one, or?
So I have two, and when you said I'm a new mom, I'm kind of a new old mom. I have an 18-year-old son and a 4-year-old daughter.
Ah, okay, okay. So, but this is birth of a daughter, so this certainly is the more recent experience at giving birth.
And when I say daughter, I also refer, there's kind of a double meaning. I'm also referring to myself as a daughter and kind of looking deeply and reflecting on that role of being a daughter and how that changes when you're a mother. Now, of course, you know, as a second-time mother, I did reflect on that earlier, but I think there was something different for me having a daughter and being a daughter that I really saw, you know, and wanted to reflect on that shift. So there's a lot of me in the book of poems, even though it's also about my daughter.
Yeah, and that is interesting. So in a sense, your own daughterness or daughterhood here is, I don't know, perhaps a little bit reborn in your experience of having your own daughter?
It was, and there's also a little bit of sadness tinge to it, because I'm kind of a motherless daughter. My mother passed away before my daughter was born, and my mother-in-law also passed away before my daughter was born. So there's a lot of reflection on, you know, how can you be a daughter without a mother? But then, and now I'm a mother with a daughter, and it's just reflecting on those experiences.
Yeah, I read a couple of the poems that seem to reflect that, I certainly send condolences for your loss and your losses of your mother and mother-in-law, and that's got to be a tough thing, especially someone who's going through the process of giving birth to her own daughter, and then all the different stages of young motherhood and early motherhood. Although, I mean, as you say, with an older son, you'd been through some of this or a lot of this stuff before, but still, I'm sure there are slightly different flavors to the whole experience, given whichever, you know, the different genders of the children you're talking about. So here, obviously, there is a continuity there from mother to daughter, or grandmother to mother to daughter, and part of that is not as available to you, and so that does have to be tough. And you reflect it quite well in some of the poems here. What would be a good give us a little reading here, if you don't mind? What would be a good what about Birth of a Daughter itself? I birth myself anew as I birth you, daughter.
Yeah.
Give us a few lines of that.
The title poem. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that to me really explains a lot when I say I'm thinking of myself and also my daughter, because it is such a powerful, you know, identity shift when you become a mother, but you're still also all the things you were. And for me, there's, you know, a little bit of a troubled background. So when I say I'm realizing things about myself, it's just, it's been a long struggle to realize that. But, and so I had my son when I was 25, and I had my daughter when I was almost 40. So that's why I joke when I say I'm a new old mom.
But yeah.
I'll read Birth of a Daughter.
Okay.
Birth of a Daughter. I birth myself anew as I birth you, daughter. I am me, plus and minus the cells expunged to create you, daughter. You arrive, doll-sized, bright-eyed, a sponge soaking up my milk. More cells I shed to make you, feed you, daughter. Am I the mushroom, the fleshy, spore-bearing, fruiting body of a fungus, or are you? Or do we form one as a verb? Do we mushroom into this life together, daughter? I write this as you are away. We call it school, though it is June and you are three. I work, I write, I sit outside in the sun, and I can't lie, it's delicious, this time away from you. It's precious, as are you. It has only taken me 42 years to realize I am precious, too.
That's beautiful. I think that's an important realization to come to at some point in one's own life. And I think sometimes you learn lessons about life in general in that whole process of birth and regeneration of the species and all of that. Is that sort of your sense?
And certainly, I think a lot of parenting requires so much of giving up of yourself in deference to another little tiny human being's needs, especially in the beginning, right? When they're babies and they're so physically dependent on you. And, you know, as they grow older, of course, they're still dependent on you for all of their needs. But what, in the early years, it's just such a disappearance of yourself as you tend to their needs first and foremost, right? Because you have to make sure the baby's fed, and you know you're keeping this little human being alive. And so, for me, that disappearing self, you know, it can really be harmful. You of course have to do your self care and take care of yourself so that you can take care of others. So for me to think, you know, here I am. Every parent is always thinking, oh, my child's the best. I love them. They're precious. They're a genius. They're amazing. But you also have to think about that for yourself. You have to love yourself in order to love and care for others. So I think for me that poem really, really says that, you know, trying to reconcile loving myself to be able to love my daughter more fully.
And in terms of that multi-generational aspect, I'm trying to remember which of the poems here really zeroed in on. I think you were actually referring to your mother-in-law in it, and because you make reference to your husband right at the end of the poem. Is this coming coming to you? I'm trying to find it. I should have marked these better when I was reading them last night.
It's the one on page 36, and that is about my mother-in-law and how we celebrated her birthday going to the beach, but you know she had already been passed. So it was kind of a bittersweet moment to be there with family, but without her, but how I see a lot of her in my daughter. And that poem talks about that.
Yeah. And I've got to say, you know, one thing that is nice about this poetry is that it, to someone who's not a quote unquote poetry expert or whatever, like me, it's pretty accessible. And I was just reminded of that looking at, the title of this poem, How to Celebrate a Dead Mom's Birthday. And Maybe we can talk more about that on the other side of a break. We got to go to some CBS News at the bottom of the hour and a couple words from our sponsors. Samantha Kolber is my guest. She is a poet in Montpelier and is just out with a new collection called Birth of a Daughter. And we'll be back in just – actually, first let me mention – at the top of the hour, just after the news, we're going to have a news conference with Governor Phil Scott and other top state officials talking about the latest twists and turns in the state's response to the COVID-19 crisis. So when you get to the top of the Dave Graham Show here at 11 o'clock, don't touch that dial. Just stay right with us. You'll be able to hear the governor's regular Friday. Tuesday and Friday is the cycle now, a news conference. We'll be back. We'll be back in a couple minutes, folks.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Daily takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
Wanted to mention our podcast. I sometimes forget, but I mean to tell you and remind you that I know a lot of people are busy between 9 and 11 a.m. on weekday mornings. You're going to work. You're going to doctor's or dentist appointments, doing something with your kids, et cetera, et cetera. Lots of stuff going on. It might keep you from listening to our show when it's live here on WDEV FM and AM. And, of course, streaming online. But if you want to catch up later, if there's a topic that you missed, you wanted to hear the discussion, you can always go to our podcast. Just go to WDEVradio.com is the website for the station. Follow the link from there to the Dave Graham Show. If you scroll down a little bit when you get there, you will come up with a list of our recent programs by date and by topic and by guest. And you will be able to zero in on whatever it is you want to catch up with, and I think it's a good way for our show to sort of broaden its footprint. And I'm really happy that the Warren Store, the friendly, funky, and almost world famous Warren Store, has been sticking with us for quite a while now, sponsoring our podcast, and really appreciate that support. Let's get back to our conversation with Samantha Kolber. She is the poet, Montpelier based poet, behind a new collection called Birth of a Daughter, and pretty straightforward title there. It might give you a good clue about what most of these poems, if not all of them, refer to, and that is motherhood and having a child, and very very well crafted and descriptive poetry about what is the what is that experience like. Samantha Kolber, I remember when we were about to have our first kid. He was born in December, and we were actually going to Mass, Catholic Mass, and the priest was talking about delivering the sermon about Advent as a time of pregnancy. And I turned and glanced at my wife, Kathy, and it was amazing to me how rosy red her cheeks were. She just looked like she was about to bear fruit or something. Yeah. I don't know. I'm sorry?
She must have been glowing. That's what they say.
Yeah. It seemed that way. It was pretty amazing. Just a little glimpse of a moment there. So, that's one of the lovely things about poetry, I think, is you can take just tiny moments like that and sort of make note of them and then build something out of that experience. And I'm wondering, what is your process like there? Talk to me about how you find things to write about and then do that craft work.
Sure. And before I get into that, I'd like to just take a moment and say thank you to our listeners listening today. And it's a hard day. You know, I was listening to your show earlier and the news. It's a hard day with remembrance and loss and grief. And I just want to thank our listeners for tuning in and hold that space for all the difficult feelings everyone is having today. And so that actually segues nicely into how I write or why I write poems, which is because we have difficult feelings and emotions and we have to put them somewhere and we have to process them. And for me, part of processing my emotional turmoil or even just my life, what I'm doing, what I'm seeing, what I'm smelling, what I'm hearing, I process that by writing it down. So I keep a journal and I'm constantly writing things in it. And as you said about commemorating like a moment, like turning a little moment into a poem, with that poem you mentioned before the break, How to Celebrate a Dead Mom's Birthday, that came about because, as I said, we went to the beach with my family at a beach on Cape Cod where my husband grew up going with his family for family vacations. And so we were there on the birthday of his mother. And so I had my journal with me, and I just wrote down, you know, we were going for walks, and I wrote that down. And I was, you know, we were flying a kite, and I wrote that down. And I just wrote down what I felt, what I saw, what I smelled, what I heard. You know, there's a seagull's cry in the poem. So I just wrote in the moment. And then, of course, later, the process to turn that into a poem, that's where the real work begins. You know, I take it out of my journal by typing it up into a Word document and playing with the line breaks and the forms. There are lots of forms of poetry, from traditional sonnets. There's couplets. There's rhyming or unrhymed. You know, there's lots of ways that you can create a poem. And sometimes, you have to match the content of the poem with the form. Sometimes I break my lines and make the form by what I hear. You know, I'll read the poem out loud, and I can hear where there's certain pauses or breaks. Sometimes I use a rhyme scheme to keep the rhythm and pull the form out. And with this one, the How to Celebrate a Dead Mom's Birthday, it felt like they needed to be couplets because it was a coupling to me to marry this moment to the feelings I was having, like a bittersweet feeling of remembering our mother-in-law, my mother-in-law who had passed, and then seeing my daughter, you know, being so very alive and so very, so very Susan, as I say in the poem. She embodies a lot of qualities of her late grandmother. So that's kind of the process of how that happens. There's lots of editing that will happen. Poets and writers often have other poets and writers that will look at their work, maybe a writer's group or a poet's group, where you can get feedback. That's very important. I think a lot of people think that poets and writers do their work in a vacuum. You know, you're alone somewhere in a desk or in a room. And we do mostly, but it's great to have that outside feedback and somebody can tell you, you know, that line isn't working or I don't understand this imagery. You know, you don't want to be too abstract, but you also don't want to give away too much in the poem. You know, a poem is there to create a feeling in the reader. And so there's a delicate balance you want to strike between the words you use to make those feelings.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting point you make about not wanting to give away too much, but also not being too abstract. And, I hear quite a number of lay people from time to time when the subject of poetry comes up, which doesn't often, but, you know, occasionally people talk about it. And a very common complaint that I hear from people who don't routinely read poetry or have never really tried to write any poetry is that it's too abstract. They can't really make head or tail of what the poet is trying to say. I find my own reading of your poetry, I'm thinking to myself, I would say on the more understandable end of that spectrum. You know, it's pretty accessible, I think. But do you work on making it accessible, or do you worry about poems that might become too abstract and leave most readers behind, or how do you strike that balance?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I definitely have some other poems that might be a little more abstract, but I tend to write as I talk. You know, it's like a conversation to me. Of course, you know, since a poem is a work of art, you know, you do want to make sure that on the page, you know, it has that form, like I said, that makes it the work of art. And sometimes, you know, there's lots of art. There's abstract, when you're talking about fine arts, right, paintings, there's abstract art and there's concrete art. So sometimes you look at a painting and you know that's a barn and a cow. Sometimes you look at a painting and you're like, what is that? It makes me feel confused. And those are two valid forms of art. And so poetry can do that too. Poetry can be, you know, a metaphysical abstract notion or feeling, and most readers will look at that and say, what is that? I'm confused. And other poems, you know, while they might be there and say, you know, this is a barn or a cow, or in my poems they're like, this is a pregnant body, or this is a breastfeeding mother, I think there's still an element of a little bit of abstract there. And at least that's what I try to do, because I want the poems to be both a work of art and also a conversation that people can understand, and a story that people can understand when they read it.
Yeah, I mean, and I think when they work best, and many of these do, I would say what you're getting at really is a layered experience where you could read it as a simple story effort in storytelling. You know, here's what it's like to breastfeed my child, or you could read it as if there's symbolism in that act of breastfeeding that talks about, you know, the circle of life, or makes a more philosophical point and that kind of thing. And I think that's actually a very cool activity, I think, to try to craft something which has those multiple layers kind of reflecting off of one another, you know, you can sit back when you're done with it and look at it and go, yeah, okay. And I'm sure that actually, you've got to have a long process, or I would imagine a process of tweaking. You talked about editing, but I mean, a lot of times it's probably just a little nudge of a line here and there, right?
Oh, yes. I mean, depending on the poem, it could be a nudge or it could be a major cut. You know, there's a poem that I have in here. It's called Breastfeeding Dyad. And the form it has, there's a left, kind of a left column and a right column, with lines on the left and lines on the right, and it's broken up. There's a lot of white space on the page. And that took a lot of work to get to this form. For me, you know, I always used to just put my poems on the left justified, kind of like a list. And this poem wasn't working for me in that form until I was doing a post-grad semester, and my mentor, Laurent Bosselaar, she's a fantastic poet, she started telling me, you know, break up your forms, use your white space on your page, you know, don't hug the left line. And I looked at this poem, which is about, it's a metaphor about breastfeeding and being, you know, tied together, like in a symbiotic relationship with your baby. And I looked at the lines and I realized they should be pulled out so that on one side you have one set of lines and another side you have another set. And it was very much, to me, it represented like that symbiotic relationship of the mother and the baby, but then also you read the lines together going one way, and that's the cohesive one, like the mother and baby as one when they're a breastfeeding unit. And so, you know, that took a lot of editing, because I had to, you know, I had to get that outside feedback. Like I said, it's great to get other poets looking at your work. And then I had to really experiment and really play with those lines on the page and pull them around until it made sense. And that one I just love. I'm really proud of it, because I think it's a poem where the form completely matches the content and the function of the poem. You know, I named it a dyad, which is that two, you know, it's like, what's the dyad? Like the circle of two, I believe, of like, and that symbiotic relationship of two together.
Yep.
So it takes a lot of creative thinking sometimes when you're working on a poem and you want it to convey something, and you want it to really jump out on the page. You don't just want the words to be there kind of flat on the page.
Well, it's an amazing process, in part because, I mean, you were saying it took a lot of editing, and just glancing at this looks like a poem that is altogether fewer than 100 words. I mean, it's probably 50 or 60 at the most. And yet when you, and so, you know, I come out of a journalism background where, You know, mm-hmm. I think of a story, a quick daily story might be 500 words or 1,000 words or something. And it gets some editing for sure. You know, you want to read it over, make sure you don't have a lot of typos and the facts are all straight and et cetera. That's journalism. This is a completely different process in the sense that, you can be a lot sparser with the words, I guess would be one way to describe it. And at the same time, each one kind of gains in value that much and has to be even more exactingly the right word, right?
Yeah. I have a friend who's a fiction writer, and when I would read him my poems, he would say, "How do you fit so much into so few words?" And because it's different than writing long-form fiction or journalism. Yep. You are taking, like I talked about earlier, the big emotions, right, these big feelings, and you're distilling it to the, kind of like the fewest amount of words possible to still say something so huge. And that's kind of, to me, what poetry means in a nutshell.
Yeah, that is a very distilled form in at least the best of it. And that's actually, I would imagine, for a fiction writer, somewhat for a journalist too, but especially a fiction writer who wants to fill a whole book, it's got to be scary to think, wow, you know, how would I fill a whole book if all of a sudden I were supposed to distill all my stuff to this degree? I guess that's why they don't. So, yeah, your son was 18 at the time your daughter was born, Samantha, or is he 18
well,
now?
He was 14 when she was born. They're 14 years apart. So he's
I see. Okay.
Now and she's four. Yeah.
Right. And is he poetically inclined or what's
No, he is quite the opposite of me. he's very concrete. He's in school for architecture now.
Oh wow.
Yeah, he's in college and he's also an artist. He's in the art and architecture program and he loves to draw and take photographs. But his brain is very much more mathematically inclined than mine. however, I do see a lot of verbal and communication skills in my daughter. She loves to rhyme. She loves to read. She loves books. So she might have a little bit of the writing gene yet.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I suspect that there actually may be, I don't know, more commonality between some various art forms than might even be immediately apparent. I mean, I remember studying some music in my past life, and you know, you look at a piece by Mozart, and you can actually sort of feel, at least at some level, the architecture there. You know, there's actually real structure to it. And I remember taking a course once in magazine writing, and the professor there was talking about how a magazine article, a good one, is frequently, you know, very structured, and so it's just sort of fascinating to me that, you know, if you're in a music theory class, you're going to learn about the structure of a symphony or the movement of a symphony or whatever. If you are in a magazine writing class, there's structure that, you know, you don't even notice if you pick up the New Yorker and just read an article, but it's there.
Yeah.
And the writer knows about it, and the editor knows about it. So it's fascinating to me that there is that commonality, and I bet you there's more. You have more in common between your poetry and your son's architectural efforts than maybe readily apparent. So, just a guess.
Yeah. And that's funny that you bring up the music because he's very musically talented and inclined. He grew up playing the viola since he was 9 years old, and he was in the Green Mountain Youth Symphony. And now he plays the guitar. He switched from, you know, the more classical instrument to a cool guitar because he's a college kid now. But he's very good with music. And you know, there's music and language, too, not just the structure that you talk about structuring a piece of writing and a piece of music, but music itself. There's music in our language, right? And that's what poetry does. It brings out the music in our language, whether it's rhymed or unrhymed. There's always a rhythm and a musicality to poetry and to any writing, even, you know, a good novel, a good essay will have that too. So yeah, I love the connection between the music.
As a general rule, I've sometimes thought of of poetry as kind of a way station on the path between music and literature. I mean, or between music and prose, let's say. It's clearly, poetry is a type of literature. Does that make sense to you?
It does make sense. And I see poetry not only a bridge between music and literature, but also art, because like I talked about earlier, on the page, when you look at a poem, you can tell right away it's a poem instead of something else because of the different line breaks and the different white space around the page. So I think poetry is like music and art and literature all put together.
All right. Well, speaking of art, if we're going to go visual here, what is the art on the cover? It's really quite compelling of your collection,
you
Birth of a Daughter.
That. Yeah, it's a watercolor painting that my daughter did when she was 3. And I just thought it was perfect for this collection. She actually calls this piece of artwork Mommy Monster.
Mommy Monster.
You know, I thought it was funny, especially because there's a lot of poems that can be a little tinged with sadness, like I said, with the grief of losing my mother's. But also, I ended up with postpartum depression when my daughter was younger. And while the poems don't actually say that outright, there's a lot of poems that kind of allude to a depressive mood. So I think it was very interesting that while she was painting, she might have picked up, there's a lot of black watercolor and a lot of, you know, chaotic lines in this abstract painting that kind of convey that mood to me, that maybe mommy was feeling like a monster that day. I was feeling a little down. But again,
yikes.
You know, writing is a way for me to process that, and it's a way for me to get all those feelings out on the page so that I can be more present for my daughter. So, but I do love the cover, and it does get a lot of notice from people.
Yeah, it's great. Well, maybe your daughter has a future as a visual artist. Who knows what a kid will turn out to be. Samantha Culver, I want to thank you so much for joining me. This has been a really fun conversation, and I wish you the best of luck with this collection. I hope a lot of people check it out, and onward and upward.
Thank you, Dave. The book is available at Bear Pond Books, and I'm signing books there. So if somebody wants a personalized signed copy, they can get that at Bear Pond Books.
Excellent. All righty. Well, thanks again. We're going to about wrap up the Dave Graham Show here for this Friday, September the 11th. And I want to thank my colleague, Dana Jewell. He's the guy who cues us up, and he makes it all flow and work here on the Dave Graham Show. Dana's going to be retiring a week from today, and he's just announced that this morning. He's been doing long and excellent career in radio, and really got to commend him for the work he's done. Thank you very much, Dana, for being the brains behind the operation here.
Dave.
That's about it for the Dave Graham Show. We'll be visiting with you again on Monday, and Dana will be back one more week, so it'll be fun. All right. Have a good day, everybody.